That's right.
Can I ask you a little bit about how that came about? But perhaps I ought to just announce a new reel before we start.
Yes.
Can I just... Charles Simpson, Reel 2. Can you tell me about how you came to join the Royal Navy?
Yes.
And also, can I ask you to...
Yes, I was encouraged, having moved over to the dockyard side, to concentrate my mind upon my future and to make a very early decision, probably at the age of 12 or 13, as to which way I wanted my life to go after leaving the secondary school. And the options were clearly stated in my case as being to become an apprentice in the dockyard or an apprentice in the Royal Navy. Each required the passing of a national examination. And I chose to take the examination for entry into the Navy as an artificer apprentice. That had enormous advantages for me because the training establishment was in three very old ships anchored at the top of Portsmouth Harbour. So it was permissible for me to visit home once a fortnight, which I would not have been able to do had the establishment been anywhere else than in Portsmouth.
Would this have been... You joined the Royal Navy in, it would have been about, this would be 1925.
No, it was January the 4th, 1926. And 85 other boys joined at the same time. We were required to wait outside the Portsmouth Dockyard gate at 4 o'clock on a winter's afternoon. All boys came from the kind of schools who wore coloured caps. So one must imagine 85 boys in their school caps standing in the pouring rain outside Portsmouth Dockyard Gate. At precisely 4 o'clock, a petty officer came out and said, "Follow me." And we had to walk through Portsmouth Dockyard, over bridges and casoons in the darkness. And we boarded a steam boat and were taken, I imagine, 2.5 to 3 mile trip up to HMS Tiscar. The first thing we were required to do, standing in the gymnasium, was to sign a form declaring that we would serve in His Majesty's Navy for 12 years from the age of 18. So at the age of 15, my future to the age of 18 plus 12, 30, was decided.
And what else happened on that very first day?
On that very first day, we were given a walk around the living quarters of the ship, and for us, that comprised living on what was referred to as the chest flat. Every boy was given possession of a sea chest, and this became the furniture of your home for the next 4.5 years. The chests were arranged in regimental fashion in rows across this incredibly long open space within two decks of the ship. We were arranged in classes, and each class lasted 6 months. The classes were referred to by alphabet, so the class one joined was A class. After 6 months, you passed to B class, and so on every 6 months till you joined the senior class, where the apprentices were 19 years, 20 years old, called J class. And J class, by its mere title, held the respect and in some cases the awe of everybody in the establishment until you reached J class. So on the chess flat, we were likewise divided into groups, and A class were directed to take over possession of a chest in the group allocated to us. So we had choice of a chest, but very little else.
How did you sleep?
We slept in hammocks above the chest. The hammocks were kept in what was referred to as the hammock site. Each was allocated a hammock, and that occupied our attention for the first evening on board the ship.
What was it like sleeping in a hammock for the first time?
Having arrived at the chess flat and having been told which were our particular group, our attention was then directed to a hammock, was taken from the, I've forgotten the name of the stowage, it had its special title. A petty officer pulled the hammock from its stowage and said he was about to teach us how to sling a hammock. He then proceeded to tie the hammock on rods which were suspended above the chest. And he showed us how to dislodge ropes at each end of the hammock and put a rope over one bar which had an indentation in it to take the rope, and then he flung the rope over another bar some 6 feet away. And then hoisting on each rope in turn and tying a special knot in it, he left the hammock suspended some 6 feet above the ground. He then unlashed the hammock, and we discovered that a piece of rope had to be passed at even spaces from the top of the hammock, coiled around the hammock, taken a little bit further along the hammock and turned round again, and finished with a knot at the far end of the hammock. We were told the space between the hammocks was regulated, and the petty officer said, God help you if you lash your hammock in any other way. He then showed us how to clamber into the hammock. And the procedure was, taking hold of one of the bars, you flung your legs into the air in the hope that legs in your bottom would land inside the hammock. And you can well imagine that for the first 2 or 3 weeks, several of the first swings landed anywhere but in the hammock. But after a fortnight, maybe even for the clever ones in the week, They learn to fling their legs into the air, clad in pyjamas, safely into the hammock. The procedure for getting ready for going to bed was to spread the blankets first, so you landed into the blanket, which you then folded over the top of yourself. Bedtime for junior apprentices was 9 o'clock, and you were kept to that bedtime very strictly until you reached E class, when your bedtime was extended till 10 o'clock. So until the age of 20, my bedtime, judged light by the Royal Navy, was 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock.
Can I ask you, were you issued with a uniform on the first day?
No. On the second day, we were, to use the naval term to which we were obliged to get used, we were mustered in the gymnasium, where our measurements were taken for our first uniform. The first uniform was made of a serge material, and we quickly discovered that most apprentices save sufficient money in the first year to be able to purchase a suit made out of a very much better material than the serge. This was every boy's ambition, to save enough money to change his first uniform. Boys who were urged by their parents to save money, and one boy in my class in particular, neglected to save the money, and he remained in his first serge suit until the end of the second year. He was regarded as being something unusual in not wanting to get into a better looking suit. Now, about the uniform. My first uniform was in black buttons. But everybody 6 months senior to me was in brass buttons. But in the Christmas before I joined, those apprentices wearing brass buttons were obliged to change them into black buttons. And so those apprentices whom I had before I joined, and who had been seen about the town, and particularly on Chelsea Front, wearing bright brass buttons, and which had encouraged me to think that I was going to wear brass buttons, a sign at the time of some dignity and position within the Navy. But no, it was not to be my good fortune to wear brass buttons until I was advanced to petty officer. And that was some 3 years after I left the apprentices. No, it had been the practice for apprentices to be advanced to the position of chief petty officers on leaving the apprentice establishment. So my friends, who were 6 months senior to me, left as chief petty officers. I and my classmates left as leading seamen. and we had to wait a very considerable time before we became chief petty officers.
Can I ask you what the eating arrangements were like on HMS Fishguard whilst you were an apprentice?
Yes. We were distinguished from all other ratings in the Royal Navy by having to do no domestic duties. We were served at mealtimes by pensioners, who of course were civilian by then, and had a nickname. They were called gobbies.
Could you say that again?
The gobbies served our meals, which at breakfast and dinner time, dinner was at midday, not referred to as lunchtime. At breakfast and dinner time, the meals were served by the gobbies, who handed things over their shoulders and laid them onto the table. But the practice at supper time was to lay, usually, meals in a solid form, like pies, were laid at the head of the table, and you reached for them. So that was usually an undignified procedure of waiting at the head of the table, reaching over the shoulder of the boy in front of you, and, to put it politely, grabbing the pie, the pork pie or the meat pie that was allocated.
And where were the meals served?
These were served on the meals flat, which corresponded in size to the chest flap and was on the lower or maybe an upper floor, I've forgotten which.
You said you're an apprentice artificer.
Yes.
Could you explain what that is?
Yes. An artificer is defined in the Bible as a worker in fresh metals. An artificer is a man who at that stage was capable of making the most intricate things out of pure metal. So, a fitter and turner, which I became, was capable of manufacturing replacements for the machines used in Her Majesty's ships from pure metal. If a replacement shaft was required, you manufactured it on board the ship. And the apprenticeship was as lengthy as it was, 4.5 years, because you progressed from a boy using a hammer and chisel to a fully qualified fitter and turner, or coppersmith, or blacksmith, depending upon the trade which after a year you were allowed to choose. Up to that time, the things you did, I beg your pardon, 6 months. Every boy did the same things for the first 6 months, but after that time you were obliged to make a choice within the numbers required of the various trades offered by the Navy. I chose fitter and turner. And in the 4.5 years, I learned to manufacture things, to the nearest thousandths of an inch. You'd be interested to know what the very first job was, which all boys had to undertake at the age of 15 or 16. You were led into a workshop where there were 86 other vices, just enough to accommodate our entry. Each boy was handed two chisels and a hammer, referred to by the instructor as a two-pound hammer and a cross-cut and flat chisel. We were then handed a piece of mild steel, the size and shape of a milk tin. And we were told by the instructor our very first job was to convert this cylinder with the use of the chisel and hammer into a hexagonal shape. And this was attained by marking off the hexagon to which you hope to arrive on the ends of the cylinder and marking out the shape with what were called centre punch pops. A centre punch was a sharp tool which you indented the metal with the hammer. So we were given a template, the size of the hexagon, and we marked it out on the end. And then the instructor demonstrated the use of the narrow chisel, which was to cut a groove the whole length of the cylinder down to the top of the hexagon. And you then remove the two pieces of metal either side of the groove with the use of the flat chisel. Imagine schoolboys, 15 years of age, having to use a hammer and chisel on a solid block of steel to change its shape from a cylinder to a hexagon. We quickly acquired the skill because if you missed the end of the chisel, you hit your hand. Both the chisels and the hammer raised blisters on the palms of your hand, and of course within a couple of days you had cuts and bruises on your hand. So older apprentices tipped you off to wear a pair of socks on your hands, to sacrifice a pair of socks to the workshop. And it's amazing, every boy, without exception, produced a block that truly resembled a hexagon, but with chisel marks in it.
Were the workshops aboard HMS Fisherman?
They were on a separate ship. One of the three hulks was used as an accommodation and recreation ship. One was used as the workshops for the apprentices, and the third ship was used for offices, accommodation for the ship's officers, and such other things as the hospital, sick bay, and so forth. That was normally out of bounds to us.
You told me about the first thing that you were asked to do when you started your apprenticeship. What sort of things were you making towards the end of your apprenticeship?
We progressed and made such things as later on we would make all at once. The apprentice time was clearly divided into two parts. At the end of D class, we were set an examination, both technical and educational, and also a trade test. And these were set by the Admiralty. The examination carried 6 subjects, and the trade test was given a limited time to accomplish. And at that time, we all assembled in our various workshops, because, of course, by that time, we were clearly divided into our separate trades, requiring a separate trade test. The trade test at the end of D class was to take the hexagon you had made in A class and fit it into a hexagonal hole in a much, much larger hexagon. So it comprised 3 hexagonal shapes, an outer one, a hole, and a plug-shaped hexagon. And the skill required was such as to require you to be able to push the plug into its hole on a flat surface in such a way that it imprisoned air between the flat surface and your hexagon. A good fit was regarded as one lying on a flat surface, you could not push it to the end of the hole.
And what sort of things were you making at the end of J class?
In J class, we were once again required to pass a technical examination of 6 subjects and a trade test set by the Admiralty. And this was an extremely complicated piece of mechanism which varied every 6 months. So it was not possible to gain any hints or tips from anyone as to what your particular trade test would be. My own was called a jib and cotter. And it was an assembly put together from about, as far as I recall, 8 or 9 separate pieces, which, in order to be safely put together, by safely I mean correctly put together, each piece had to be made to within 1/1000 of an inch. These pieces required us to make use of every machine we had used throughout our apprenticeship. So it collected together in one piece of mechanism made of several different materials. It put together all the skills we had acquired over the previous 4.5 years. Now, this examination and trade test were of vital importance because they were marked to 1/1000 of an inch degree, and you were lost to mark for every 1/1000 of inaccuracy. And we were aware that at the end of the test, they would all be sent separately to an establishment where a number of artificers, chief artificers, would measure every part. And it was important because we were to be divided after leaving the apprentice establishment according to the naval ports. A number were to be sent to Devonport, a number were to be sent to Portsmouth, and the remainder to Chatham. You were allowed to nominate which port you would like to belong to, and your choice depended upon your examination reports. They put together the results of the D-class exam and the D-class trade test with the results of the J-class and put on a composite list and published as a roll of honour. The choice of your port depended upon your position on the final list. So those near the top got their choice. Those at the bottom went to the depot allocated to them. Now my home was in Portsmouth. My father was employed in Portsmouth Dockyard, and my great ambition, of course, was to belong to Portsmouth Depot. But they were not allocated in equal numbers.